here. Yeah, we're on here. This is an interview with Roy Godfrey. Hi, so we go on, and why don't you start back a little bit and mention how you came on board out here at Marshall, and where you did your work, what your professional background is.
Well, I came on board here in early 53 when the Redstone was first underway, mm-hmm. before the first Redstone was assembled, mm-hmm. and I joined the Quality Assurance and Reliability Lab at that time in testing. And was in charge of the mechanical checkout of the first Redstone. Mm-hmm. Pressure checks, alignment, all of those things that required before the vehicle was sent to testing or to launching. Mm-hmm. I stayed there until I first got into project work. Eventually became the deputy to the director of the Quality Assurance Laboratory, Dieter Grau. And then went over into project work. Let me refer here to my notes and get my date straight.
Good.
So, I'll get myself tangled up. Went into the S4B stage in January 64. Project manager. At that time, the S4B was just underway as a Saturn 1B version. You know, the S4B flew on both the first Saturn 1B and then Saturn 5. That was a unique stage in that it responded to two different programs at the same time. It was a different version for the, a non-restartable version for the Saturn 1. And then for the Saturn 5, it was adapted with a different interstage and clearly the most technically demanding problem in the S4B was the coast and the restart. So in that regard, the Saturn V program manager, at that time Arthur Rudolph, and the Saturn 1B program manager, Lee James, both had a vested interest in the S4B. So I was brought in to try to answer to those two people.
Can we stop just for a minute? Since I'm also been working on the S4B, could you explain a little bit more about the problems in the coast and restart difficulties with the S4B?
Sure. At that time, no liquid stage, to my knowledge, no cryogenic stage of any size had ever been restarted.
Centaur
had not made it yet. They had not made it yet. Yeah. At the time, the S4B was first put under development. Now, Centaur tried it after, I believe it was after the S4B first flew and had difficulty, naturally. When you go to zero G and all your propellants go to spread over the tanks, float around in the tanks and get mixed up with gas, one of your greatest difficulties is settling it adequately so that you get no bubbles in the inlet of the pumps and cavitate the pumps.
Right.
Now, it takes energy to settle. And it takes time, even at a low G and low energy, it takes quite a bit of time. The original idea on the S4B was to use a brute force approach and use some solid rockets, four LH motors, to settle the LH sufficiently for start. But that was quite a performance penalty.
They finally did use the APS modules on there, for that reason, or that?
They considered, APS modules were the next choice that came along with large, of course, that's because of the performance of penalties of the solid. The S4B system carried LH rockets in its APS module, LH motors in its APS module, okay, in addition to attitude control. That was the choice, the preferred choice, after the solids were rejected because of the high performance penalty. But it was, again, a relatively high thrust and burn quite a bit of propellant. And there, even there, the performance penalty was pretty high.
Excuse me, now what do you mean about the performance penalty of the solid? Now, what's the problem?
Well, just take the performance, the I-specific of the solid compared to the storables that you used in the APS module. They weren't that much different, really, to be honest. Storables were a little better, okay?
Okay, so then that was enough.
That was enough, but you see, the problem is that with 1,500 pounds of thrust in each of the LH motors that were in the early Saturn V configuration, you had to have many seconds, because that would only give you, I believe, less than a tenth of a G. Mm-hmm. And at less than a tenth of a G, it takes quite a while to settle those propellants to be sure that no liquid is down at the bottom of the suction line and would cavitate the pump.
How long? Do you remember how long they
burned? How long they burned?
Well, I can not how long they burned, but well, that would be then how long it would take.
I believe
to,
it was 20 or 30 seconds. We were
and that's what they
were saying, to be safe.
To be safe, yeah.
Now, that takes quite a bit of propellant. Yeah. So eventually, before we flew, the solution was adopted to use hydrogen gas and then it with very low thrust over a long period of time. In fact, you continued to vent. You had a continuous vent system, venting the hydrogen continuously, mm-hmm. and never letting the propellant get completely unsettled. Mm-hmm. Now, to prove that, we flew an S-4B stage configured so as to try that. In other words, after we completed the S-4B two-stage mission and had the S-4B in coast, we had sufficient hydrogen. We had an early shutoff, you see, and had sufficient hydrogen left to settle it with a very low G, 10 to the minus 4, I believe, something like that, on that order, that I'm sure you can look up the numbers.
Yeah, was this on the Saturn 1B?
That was on the Saturn 1B.
Right, I forgot the launch.
And it was SA-203. Okay. It was the restart mission for the Saturn V vehicle to prove that approach. Now, we believe that the Centaur problem was that they didn't have sufficient time completely settle, and they started with a, you know, essentially a free-falling stage, mm-hmm. of the zero-G stage. So this continuous, very low thrust, just from emitting hydrogen gas as the hydrogen boil-off, you see, developed because mm-hmm. of the heat input into the tank and orbital coast, we continuously vented and kept 10 to the minus 4G positive thrust. And that 203 had a television camera to look at that hydrogen and be sure of the configuration. So that proved to our satisfaction that it would work, and that was ultimately adopted. So we were still sweating that restart out, because not only did you have to have propellants, both hydrogen and LOX, settled, you had to have the engine temperature right and all of the systems, conditioning of the engine.
Had to chill down there.
You had to have a chill down sequence, and generally I'd say the biggest sweat on S4B, its mass fraction was reasonable, but it was really an S4 stage, a blown-up S4. I'm sure you've heard this before.
Right. Yes.
So there was no new state-of-the-art there. The J2 was new, and of course we learned how to use that in the early 1B flights. But it was a raw engine. It took some shaking down in flight. But the Saturn V in the Saturn V configuration, we start with a big sweat. We fired the engine at Arnold under vacuum conditions. We still encountered a problem with it, of course. You've heard of the ASI line.
I just now jotted that down to ask you about it. Yeah.
Right.
You were okay as long as you mentioned it. Could you explain that a little bit for me, please?
Sure. ASI line was a problem which was not caught because of the testing sequence on the ground. It occurred only in flight conditions. Very simple. We had a flexible hose in the ignition circuit of the S4B engine going to the ASI augmented spark igniter carrying the hydrogen or LOX, I forgot which, one or the other. So in any event, this flexible hose on the ground was cold. It was chilled. It was a cryogenic hose, in other words. Mm-hmm. Now, it was a bellows hose with a braid, stainless steel braid over the top of the hose. Mm-hmm. You've seen that type of hose,
right?
And on the ground, ice developed due to the moisture from the atmosphere condensing, of course, between the braid and the bellows, and stiffened that hose. Yeah. And in all the ground testing, it worked beautifully in the stiffened condition. However, after you got it up out of the atmosphere, and even on the ground at the launch site, we had an hydrogen purge. It didn't have sufficient as much moisture anyway, and up in the vacuum condition, the ice was gone, and that darn bellows resonated and broke under a few seconds of flow. It was a flow resonance problem. It was undetected on the engine because the engine was always fired at sea level. And even at Arnold, we didn't have sufficient vacuum long enough, you see, in the testing up there to cause the hose to fail. Now, the The hoses we qualified were not qualified under vacuum cryogenic conditions. That would be a system test, in a sense. Even though we had a tremendous qualification program, the hoses were not qualified that way. We didn't expect that icing to be a factor, frankly.
Oh, yeah.
So it was missed until we actually flew and found it. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's quite a story with how we ran down the nature of the problem.
Yeah, who did most of the running down on that? Do you remember?
Was
it
tremendous,
Marshall, or was it
tremendous joint venture. You see, the thing happened on two different stages. Remember, S2 had it?
Right.
It knocked two engines out. Knocked one engine out on the S2, and the S4B failed to start. Mm-hmm. Both, as luck would have it, all on one vehicle. So all of the North American people on S2 were busy. The Douglas people, of course, were busy, and all of Marshall, all propulsion. Now, we traced down on the S2, we had a temperature profile because of the large amount of instrumentation around the engine. And for example, I was with S2 at that time. I know that story. And we began to pinpoint the source of the leak, the direction of the gas flow, because of the temperature response all around the engine.
Yeah.
We began to suspect the area where the problem started. And then it was simply a matter of suspecting that particular hose and reproducing the conditions that would cause the failure.
You figured out the only spot that gas leak.
We had two or three candidates that could have possibly caused a failure the way it failed. We knew the engine started okay on the first start, you see.
Right.
And in S2, as it got up in altitude far enough, the ice sublimed quickly away, and it failed. And then the S4B failed on the start. It ran through its first burn successfully. It didn't. It was a marginal condition. And then it failed in its second burn. So we pinned down the possibilities and knew there was only a few components that could have caused the failure in such a manner a few seconds after a start. We suspected a start problem. So then we started testing the hoses. Somebody had the bright idea, hey, this hose has never been tested in vacuum, and they failed the vacuum. As soon as we got in vacuum, it popped at 15 seconds.
Remember who?
A Marshall guy said, hey, no, wait, was it a Marshall or a contractor guy? I can't remember which propulsion cat finally thought of that.
Yeah.
We were all working so hard at the same time, but as soon as, I believe it was a Marshall man over at Furman's shop. Herbert Furman was a mechanical man over
at
Furmann. I believe it was one of his people who said, hey, let's try that hose under vacuum conditions. But I'm not sure.
Yeah.
Wouldn't want to give credit to the wrong guy. In any event, it was typical of how we chased several serious problems. Everybody's entire resources, we had a communication net, you might say, exchange information each day. Certain people did some sort of one type of testing, and others did other things. We suspected an actuator, and some people chased all the actuator problems down. We simply narrowed down finally. We tried that one test. That was a clear answer. And then we reproduced that. Very simple. Just put a heavy hose on it. It wouldn't fail in...
Did you use the same bellows type of hose?
Heavier bellows hose.
Yeah.
That's all it took. We re-qualified every hose that had not been vacuum tested in the entire vehicle, of course, that had cryogenics in it.
Yeah.
Naturally, when you miss one, you miss several others.
Right.
So that was the most serious problem ever encountered on the S4B, I guess, in flight, and one of the second most serious in the S2. Because when the S2 engine was knocked out by the ESI failure and it shut itself down, fortunately, in a forgiving manner, that shutdown uncovered another problem, some crossed wires, which shut down another engine. Because the crossed wires occurred during the modification and were not found in the systems re-verification test because they didn't run an engine-by-engine shutdown sequence, you see. Didn't run all the failure modes and missed that particular wiring problem. So that caught two engines on the S2 and it was touch and go. The guidance was not designed for that failure, but it just made it. We had successful guidance with two engines out on the S2.
It wasn't designed for two. It was designed for one engine.
It was designed for one engine out.
Yeah.
But the guidance did accommodate both engine failures. We didn't have a disturbance sufficiently large to cause us to lose control.
I hadn't thought about that aspect of it.
In fact, the mission rules were to abort the mission with a two-engine failure on S2. The mission control saw we had lost two engines. After we thoroughly confirmed we had lost thrust on two engines, and to our satisfaction, we made a decision to continue to fly because we were maintaining control and we had nothing to lose. That one was unmanned. But then that was 502, I believe.
Yeah, and actually,
and then,
there
and
were
then
other
that,
problems, the Pogo,
S1
Pogo.
That was the S1C Pogo.
Yeah. So in order to get ready for 503, you had to solve...
We had two problems. We had the ASI, which was a narrow problem, but once it was clearly identified, no problem to prove it, you see.
Yeah.
The Pogo is a little different. Incidentally, the problem probably would not have resulted, ever resulted in a vehicle problem.
Pogo, you mean?
Pogo. The Pogo level in the S1C was an extremely low-level Pogo. Now, there was a coupling up in the, of course, up in the spacecraft with lateral Gs, but the lateral Gs that did develop were well below the structural limits. However, Pogo is a strange thing. You never know when it's going to get worse. It's unlikely that would have got worse, but we decided to fix it. Now, there, the solution was fairly straightforward. It was similar to that had been used on the Titan. It's an accumulator fix.
Right.
And you simply tune out the resonance between the propulsion system and the engine and the structure in a free flight condition, which, of course, you never, none of the Pogo, by the way, on S1C or S2 either, was ever detected on the ground or could be reproduced on the ground after we detected it in flight.
That's interesting.
You didn't know that. Well, the reason being, is that when you fire the stage on the test stand, the stage is more restrained. In the vehicle, it has the entire vehicle freedom, you see. It's a free-flying article with a total vehicle hooked up in a free mode, and all of its structural and aerodynamic and thrust interactions giving it a certain resonance. But the, so both, neither the S1C nor the S2 Pogo could be verified except what we did. We did verify that we changed the coupling frequency, of course, of the S1C and the S2. We knew what we changed. And of course, you had to calculate what your Pogo margins would be with that new propulsion fix against the known system characteristics, low frequency vibration characteristics in flight that you've measured. Okay.
Yeah, I got two questions then. One is, since Pogo was a known phenomenon and was part of the problem, I think, earlier in Titan Gemini, why there must have been studies, or why did the studies maybe not see that? And secondly, how was the Pogo missed on AS501?
On the S1C?
Yeah.
How was it missed?
Was there any Pogo on S1C?
I believe if there was, it was such a low level that it was not considered a concern. I don't think we had a structural reaction on 501.
So can you say that just sometimes that much differentiation from one bird to the next one?
Yes, definitely. In fact, the same on S2.
Yeah.
We had violent Pogo on one S2, and we had zero on others, within the noise level, you might say.
Mm-hmm. And as far as Titan Gemini, you just figured that preliminary test data didn't indicate you'd have a Pogo problem.
That's right. In fact, we had a Pogo team consisting of Titan people, in fact, all the best people in the country, who went over the entire vehicle. But in all honesty, the entire structural dynamics of the Saturn V was still under study at the time we were flying the first Saturn V.
Mm. That function of the all-up.
And indeed, I wouldn't expect you to complete your knowledge of such a system until you've flown it a couple of three times and saw the variation, because each flight's different. You know, you fly under different trajectories, you fly different Q levels, G levels, propellant loads are different, flight to flight because of the nature of the mission. So it takes you a little while to complete your homework and to get enough data to fully understand the system and understand the variations that normally happen in that system as it flies from mission to mission. So as we went back, of course, We saw some evidence in the earlier flights after we'd seen a more coupling in a later flight, like 503, we saw the S1C coupling. We could dig back into 501 and 2. In 502 we saw it. We dug back into 501 and saw a very, very low level pogo, but it would never have concerned us if it had not developed the structural resonance in 502. The level of the pogo was very low. So it was a total vehicle problem, and the solution was simply to remove all signs of any low level pulse frequencies in the S1C by putting accumulators in. And I do believe they may have done something in the spacecraft to remove that extreme sensitivity to the lateral frequencies and low frequencies. I'm not sure about that, but you'd have to talk to the MC.
Something else you mentioned, I really don't remember getting into. Did I understand you correctly to say that it's also a focal situation in the S2 stage?
Yeah, a completely different type, though. In fact, some people wouldn't call it a pogo.
Okay, maybe that's why I haven't, or why I've missed it. Can you explain that a little bit
yes.
for me? Yes,
and in fact, in my judgment, it was the single most serious problem we encountered in flight in the entire Saturn V history.
Hmm.
It came the closest to a disaster.
Which one was this, now which flight?
About 506, I believe, something like that. What happened is we've been...
The lunar, that was the...
No. 50, I'm sorry, it was not 506. It happened on... I can't be sure. I have to look it up. It's been so long.
Okay, well, yeah.
In any event, let me tell you the problem.
Yeah.
S2 didn't have... Had a... The POCO resonance. And, of course, any propulsion system has some low-level resonance,
right,
which changes during its entire burn time. It has an exciting frequency, in other words, many exciting frequencies at very low level. In the S2, there was no overall structural resonance between the launch vehicle, spacecraft, or anything else. It was a localized problem. The center engine sat on a crossbeam, in other words. Okay? Now, this particular pogo happened when that crossbeam deflection developed at around 18 to 20 hertz, okay, against the center engine resonance. In other words, the beam engine started oscillating up and down, working together in a pogo, a local pogo resonance, you might call it. That occurred rather late in the flight. And on most flights, we saw just enough evidence to want to do something about it. We're working on an accumulator fix. We saw it on an earlier flight. We couldn't calculate the probability. We had to more or less base our decision to fly the flight where it occurred. Now, again, I'd have to look back to be sure exactly which one it was on. I was on one of the ones where I was in charge of the Cape at that time, the program manager. I remember it very well. We had a fix developed, which was an accumulator fix, just like we'd used on the S1C. However, we had not had sufficient testing of that to prove that it wouldn't make the problem worse. See, we had to test it propulsion-wise at MTF, testing. And we didn't have sufficient data to run through our calculations and confirm that fix was really in the right direction. So when we flew that mission and had the failure, it was a failure which resulted in the engine shutting down just before the engine would have broken the structure.
Wow.
Now, the shutdown occurred because the pressure variations in the thrust chamber were sufficiently high that the pressure OK switch, in other words, when the pressure in the engine thrust chamber goes to a certain level, it automatically shuts down. It's an abort engine shutdown safety sequence that goes into effect. The engine propulsion or pressure chamber pressure reached a sufficiently low level during its 18 hertz variations that it shut itself down before the beam, center beam oscillations reached the point that they would have failed the beam and turned an engine loose.
That would have wiped out a lot.
That's why I said
it
was potentially the most serious problem we ever encountered.
Okay, so then you...
So then we simply put that fix on we've been developing. Testing There, I mean, they made it quite clear there was no choice. We had to fix it. Mm-hmm. But I guess the science, you might say, of predicting such structural propulsion interactions is probably one of the toughest things that big liquid people ever face. In fact, I'd say it's the toughest thing. Because you've got to have a complete knowledge of how that entire vehicle structure acts in all of its modes in flight. You have to have a complete knowledge of the propulsion system, and then you have to predict how they'll couple in all the many, many modes. And the computer model to do that is just amazing.
Well, now this Fogel showed up towards the end of the flight because of the different, the change in the vehicle's residency because of propellant depletion.
Right.
Yeah. He set up a different dynamic situation for the vehicle.
The S2 burned about 8 minutes, and I guess this is burned about 6 minutes.
Yeah, that's the same thing about the S2, is the duration of that burn. It's a long haul up there.
Yes, sir. The S4B is a long haul, too, the single engine.
That's right, yeah.
They're both on the order of 6 to 8 minutes.
Yeah. At least.
But once you turn those things on, they seem to go quite well.
Yeah, somebody told me once, you know, I was asking, well, how long that rocket engine run? He said, well, just, especially when you get into regenerative engines.
Yeah.
As long as they got fuel, they'll just keep going.
In fact, after they're in a stable condition, they get into stable condition temperature-wise after only a few seconds. Mm. And if nothing is deteriorating because of a leak, you know, or anything wrong, a temperature bearing problem, or anything of that nature, it'll run right on. Yeah. Now, that is the hydrogen engine in particular. The JT, the F1 engines, and the H1s, did eventually tend to accumulate carbon. And they cope. They wouldn't run quite as long as favorable, but you know, they still run plenty long to carry out a mission. So those, I'd say, were the toughest problems. The S2 center beam FOGO problem and the ASI on the launch vehicle side of things. Of course, we sweat many other things. We sweat fracture mechanics. We sweat the on the S2 tank. I don't know whether you ever heard of that one or not.
Well, no, I'm glad you brought that up because let me backtrack a little bit here now. How long were you on the S4B and when did you get on the S2 then?
Okay, I was on the S4B from January 1964 to December 1967. And then I was the project manager of the S2 stage from December 1967 until January 1969.
Were you the